Welcome to Everything But The Tip, the podcast that bucks the trend of the mainstream golf content being churned out by the masses. Presented by the co-founders of Smart Golf and Fitness, we're on a mission to guide golfers towards genuine improvement. No swing tips, no shortcuts, we're anti-instant gratification. Join us as we navigate the complexities of the game, offering insights on how to truly excel in golf by embracing the challenges and breaking free from the usual quick fix mentality. All right, welcome back, everyone. Today, we're going to be discussing the world of golf club fitting. Whether you're a seasoned pro just starting out, or even a beginner, the right or even the wrong fit can make all the difference in your game. From shaft stiffness to appropriate gapping and even ball selection, we're breaking down everything you need to know to get the most out of your equipment. Please welcome two of our in-house PGA professionals and in-house club fitters, both Kyle Pekka and Todd Russell, to help us discuss the topic. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks, Joe.
Psyched.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's get right to it. So let's kick off with the very first question. Why, and I'll start with Kyle, why is golf club fitting important and does skill level matter?
So golf is hard enough as it is. Having equipment that fits you and helps you essentially swing your swing and fits to that is going to make the game a lot easier. Skill level, I would say, honestly, does not matter. If you're a beginner, you have tendencies and you can find clubs that will help those tendencies. If you are an advanced player, you've obviously got tendencies as well, and you can find something that fits those. So I would say no matter what level you're at, you should be fit for clubs.
Well, I'd have to follow up with that. You speak of tendencies, depending on the equipment in your hand, especially as a beginner, those could lead to tendencies, right?
Yeah, I figured we'd get into that later, but if you've got, you know, something that doesn't fit you at all, I mean, we'll talk about, you know, examples later on, but if you've got something that's like significantly, you know, different from what you need, you're going to develop a brand new pattern that does not, you know, really mesh with what you would theoretically be trying to do.
Okay. So how do I know if my equipment is helping me or not?
I mean, first place I would start to make it really, really simple is, do I have anything in my bag that I don't like to hit? If you got a fairway wood that you're like, I've had this for 8 years and I've hit it on the course twice, like, it should probably go away. And then, like I said, we'll talk more about some of the stuff later, but do you hit all your different yardage gaps, or is there, you know, a 40-yard gap in between two of your clubs? You're like, man, I feel like that comes up a lot and I don't have a club for it. And then, yeah, we can kind of go into consistency from there. I mean, well, I'm sure we'll get a lot deeper into the questions, but that's just kind of the general overview.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to go in any certain order or specifically. So if you have the thought and you want to, you know, dive deep into answering the question, feel free. I don't know, Todd, if you have anything to add to a couple of those comments that he had made or the questions that I've asked, but let's go ahead and get you involved.
Yeah, the only thing that I would add to it that I've seen, I've been fitting for quite some time now, and I would agree with Kyle that for most people, there is a set of golf clubs that can work for them. I have been in some situations with some players that are true beginners or very beginners that have zero level of consistency, and their pattern is so off the map from swing to swing that it's nearly impossible to fit them properly into a set of golf clubs.
So what would you suggest for a player of that level of ability?
I would look more into, like, instead of like lie angles and shaft flexes, I would generalize in terms of like shaft flex, just simply based upon speed. And then I would generalize length of golf club based upon like height and arm hang, trying to get into some deep dive with lie angles, shaft weighting, ultimate shaft flex, other things that we look at when we fit players. From somebody that's got a pattern that's all over the place from swing to swing to swing, that's going to be pretty tough to dial in.
Yeah, I would say I see some parallels there to the beginner, to the junior player. You know, one of the elements you kind of want to avoid when it comes to juniors is a club that's probably too long and too heavy. You know, we all know that speed is pretty important in the game, and it's something that we're all chasing and trying to maximize. Whereas when the club starts to get a little bit too heavy, you could obviously have a negative impact on that. So for me, when it comes to like a beginner, I would agree completely. Let's have a rough idea of how fast they're swinging the club. You know, obviously there's different levels of beginners. If you take, you know, for example, a professional athlete coming into the game as a beginner, especially a formal baseball player, that definition for beginner to him is definitely different comparing to someone that obviously wasn't a professional baseball mm-hmm. player. But for this conversation, yeah, obviously at that point we want to prioritize technique. So we just need something in your hand. And as long as the shaft flex is close to how fast you're swinging the club, there's probably not going to be any long-term negative consequences. You go ahead, Kyle. You want to add to that?
Yeah. So, I would stay basically right in line with what Todd said. You want to make sure that you're not like egregiously off on length, especially like if you're 5'8", just getting into golf, and your buddy who's 6'2" has clubs that are 1/2 inch, 3/4 inch long and 2 degrees upright, and you start playing with those, like you're really doing yourself a disservice because you're going to have to find some way to get that club to meet that ground flush, and you're going to have to stand that shaft up. You'll probably end up standing up yourself, really trying to throw that toe down into the ground, and now all of a sudden that's gonna be really hard to break down the line.
So I think we're all in agreement. If you're a newcomer to the game, at the very least, make sure you've got the right length in your equipment and make sure you've got the right flex, at the very least. And you don't have to go out and spend a ton of money on a club fitting and buy a separate driver and a separate, you can probably, in a lot of cases, you know, get a box set depending on your level of ability, right? Yeah. That can suffice, you know.
I would probably throw weight in that category as well, right. Joe. You know, you get flex and weight. You all seen image keeps coming to my mind of the little kid that's got his, you know, his dad's 1974 set of clubs, and he's out swinging them in the yard, and they're 3 feet too long for him, and just massively heavy, and you know, can't even move the object. So weight would come into play for sure in that.
Okay, you see the opposite too sometimes though. You know, get these really good athletes that pick up golf late and they're swinging their 7-iron 92 miles an hour with, you know, 50 gram graphite shafts. Toothpick.
Okay. So let's get into the fitting process as a whole. Kyle, I'll start with you. Let's just describe what a fitting could potentially look like. And go ahead and discuss this as much depth, the benefits, everything you like to look at. We can isolate areas if you want. Start with driver, if you will. Or you can start with putter. It's up to you.
Let's start with irons. Okay. The reason I want to start with irons is, I mean, that makes up probably at least half your bag. And that's where I think you're going to really see some of the biggest benefits, mostly because you are interacting with the turf.
So that makes me have to ask, it was a question I was going to, if there was one, and I think you just answered
it's
it.
It's hard to say.
You just answered it, kind of.
I know I did, but it's hard to
Let
say.
Let me ask the question just in case our listeners don't catch on. But I was going to ask, if you only had the choice where you could only fit one area of a player's game, you know, whether it's, you know, long game, drivers, fairway woods, hybrids, irons, wedges, putter, ball, if you only could choose one, where would you start and why?
Me personally, I'd probably start with irons. Like I said, it makes up half your bag. And, you know, if you've got 7 clubs in your bag that are not properly fit or that are properly fit, like you're going to see a big difference. You know, if you've got that one wedge that just doesn't really fit you that well, like, yeah, you might not like that one club, but if you get improperly fit irons, you don't like 7 of them. And again, driver, I think driver fitting is super important, obviously, but at the very least, it's on a tee. You're not going to have turf interaction. Like, you got to get the flex and you got to get a head that you like and maybe move the weight around.
Well, I think
like
you could also make the argument that every hole you play, unless, of course, you're hitting driver on par threes, you're probably going to be hitting an iron.
Yeah. I mean, so.
Right. So let's, Todd, do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, I would agree. Okay. I think the fact that if you could accurately fit all of your irons, it might be 8 or 9 clubs in your bag versus 1 dialed in club in your driver.
And I would take it a step further, which I know you guys know this, but you know, we're going to get into gapping here shortly. Getting those irons fit first and knowing kind of, you know, because not everyone just automatically gets wedge through 4-iron or 3-iron, right?
Correct.
Because we're going to talk about here, I'll just say it right now. Depending on how fast you can swing a club, you might not hit your 4-iron any farther than your 5-iron, or your 5-iron any farther than your 6-iron, and so on. So one of the benefits I'll just go ahead and share now to getting fit is determining, you know, whether or not you should even have long irons in your bag to begin with. You know, because I know we still see it today. It's like, man, I don't ever hit my 4 or 5-iron because I really don't feel like I hit it any farther than my 6-iron. And in a lot of cases, that's very, very true, because every club in your bag, especially irons, as we get longer, they need to be moved at a certain swing speed to hit, you know, a desired apex, so height, in order for them to travel a certain distance. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, you start to look, if you guys have ever wondered why a women's driver, for the most part, has a little more loft, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it's because they're not moving the club as fast. And if they were to hit a 9-degree driver versus a 14-degree driver, they might actually lose distance. In a lot of cases, they do. So anyhow, let's go back to irons. Let's describe how a fitting would transpire getting fit for irons.
So the first thing I usually have people do is hit something with their own clubs, assuming that they're a golfer and they're playing golf, you know, currently, just to see what some of their tendencies are. And then kind of the first thing I look for is, do you bring the speed, or do we need the club to bring the speed? And that's kind of what we alluded to earlier is, can you swing it fast enough that you can get the most out of an iron, or do you need something that's going to have a little more pop in the bat? And this is, you know, one area where things get maybe a little complicated for some people is more distance is not always better. For irons, you want to be very consistent and you want to have proper gapping. So me, for example, should I be playing blades? Probably not, but I do. But the reason I do that is because generally I hit the ball pretty close to the center of the club face. And I want to make sure that when I hit it solid, it goes the distance that I want it to go and not further. Now, if you're somebody who hits the, you know, club all over the face, then maybe we want most of the face to be forgiving. And then that middle of the face can actually get maybe a little too hot, where if you do actually catch it flush, you nuke it an extra 15, 20 yards. If you don't hit the center of the face very often, you hit it once over the course of a round or every two rounds, who cares? You feel really cool on that one hole. You know, but if somebody who's hitting the middle of the face often, all of a sudden start seeing flyers over and over again, we're going to, you know, run into some issues, especially with gapping, because part of it is each club should be swung a little bit faster than the shorter club. But also as lofts go down, smash factor increases. But if you get some of these hot clubs with that hot center of the face, you're basically maxing out smash factor from like 8-iron all the way up to 4-iron. So unless you're adding 3-4 miles an hour club speed on each club, you're going to start to see all those irons really start to bunch up.
I think he did a good job at kind of shedding some light on the question. I'm sure you guys have gotten the same, but it's like, if the equipment is more forgiving and it goes farther, why are you using blades, right? What's the reason? And you know, the answer, I think,
because
you did
they look cool.
Yeah. No, it's because, you know, it's funny. I always think back to an interview before I was as accomplished of a player as I am now, and I didn't fully appreciate it till later. And it was with Phil Mickelson, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the exact yardage he said, but they're like, so how far do you hit your 9-iron? He's like, well, I hit it 157 yards. Might have been 167, whatever. But he said he didn't say 150 to 160. He said, I hit it 157 yards. And again, I might be off on that, but I was just blown away that he knew down to the nearest yard. Now that as I've gotten more accomplished, now I totally get that. And that makes a ton of sense. And so for me personally, you know, I used a different brand and it had a lot of technology in it. And it was really forgiving and the ball did go very far. But what did I lose? Well, I lost distance control. Yeah. I want an iron to where when I hit it on the face, it's going a very, very specific distance. And with some of these irons that are so hot and with the sweet center of gravity and the sweet spot so hot, I don't want to randomly hit that ball that goes, you know, again, we're saying flyer lies are the exception, that goes out of the blue 15 yards further, you know. But yes, as a higher handicapper that's not hitting the center of the face nearly as often, they're going to want as much forgiveness as they want, because they're not thinking about working the ball. They're not thinking about hitting it to the nearest yard. They're thinking about making contact and getting it somewhere around that green.
Yeah, they want to get it airborne. They want it to be generally the right distance.
Yeah, that's, and it comes back to the fact that you know, the ball, when it flies farther or you get on these hot faces, what does it do to the ball? It takes spin off of it. Well, you need spin to be able to curve the ball. So you get into these blade irons or these, you know, forged metal irons that look like blades, and the tour players, they have to play and curve the golf ball for a living. And especially in the shorter irons, it's pretty common theme now for a lot of the better players to go to like a combo set where the face is a little hotter on the longer irons. You don't have to curve it generally as much, and then you get more of a blade forged iron in the shorter irons where you can produce a little bit more feel and spin on the shorter shots, and then also curve the ball.
Super good point. Yeah. All right, so we're irons. We're the first thing that we've discussed is we want them to hit their equipment, right? So that's where we kind of cut you off, and we went on a little bit of a tangent. But after they've hit their equipment, what irons do we typically like to start with or have them fed with?
Every single manufacturer is going to basically send us 7 irons. So it makes sense to compare apples to apples. Now, you have to think a little bit, because if you're playing, you know, old Ping I2s, the lofts are not going to be the same as anything modern. Unless you are going like into full on blades. But
well, and I want to add, that was a sales tactic for a while, right? Some would say that anyway.
It was a sales tactic, but also like as technology has improved, it is easier to launch the ball higher with, you know, lower loft. And especially as we change shafts, you know, I remember going through like when I was going through the PGA program, one of the guys running it's like, you know, fittings changed a lot. Back in the day, it used to be like you get whatever shaft you want as long as it's an S300. So, you look confused.
As long as it was an S300.
There's one shaft available, basically. It was 130 grams.
It was a joke.
Okay. It was a joke. It's kind of like the, you know, Ford. You can get whatever color you want as long as it's black. So, you know, there's one shaft available. Jeez, that's brutal. One shaft available. It's harder to get that ball, you know, airborne. And now that we're able to move the center of gravity, like, down and back, and we're able to get shafts that kick a little bit closer to the head, that ball can launch higher with less loft. So part of it's a sales tactic. Part of it's like, all right, technology's changed a little bit. But like to Todd's point, when you do that, you also can start to reduce spin a little bit too.
Beautiful. Thanks for clarifying. Okay, so let's keep moving through the fitting process.
You know, we would basically just then determine what type of head makes the most sense. Again, based on, do you need the forgiveness or do you need the workability? I usually pull over a bunch of manufacturers that are kind of in that same kind of general.
Yeah. So how do you decide? I mean, we've got Titleist, we've got TaylorMade, we've got Callaway, we've got Mizuno, we've got Ping. Might be forgetting one, but like, where do you start?
So I usually try to grab a shaft that I think should generally fit their swing speed and their launch characteristics. You know, if they're launching it super high and swinging it super fast, we might go straight to an X100, which is extra stiff.
Well, you're jumping ahead of me. How do we choose what head, though? Like, we got all these brands, all these manufacturers.
I try to get one shaft. That way, we're hitting every single head with the same shaft. All right, that way we can literally compare apples to apples and we see what's going on with each one of these heads. So then we've got, you know, our Ping head, our Mizuno head, our Titleist head, our TaylorMade head, Callaway head. And we're going to, first off, look at data, but also kind of use the, you know, client themselves as, you know, form of feedback, because there's a good chance that a lot of these, if we're, you know, doing a good job picking the right heads, are going to perform really similarly. You need to get some warm fuzzies, you know, and fitting can be a really like kind of long, tough process for a lot of people, just because you got to hit a lot of balls if we're going to get through all the heads and the shafts and everything like that. So I tell people, like, listen, take 3 or 4 swings. If right out of the gate you like it, we'll put it off to the side. We'll hit it again, and we'll kind of start to narrow it down. If you hit a couple and you're like, this isn't for me, you don't need to try to hit it until it feels good. And then we'll start to look at data, and we'll be like, listen, you liked these 3. These 2 were clearly far and away better. And then I usually kind of have them go back and forth at those 2 again, figure out what they like. And then from there, assuming we feel confident that that head is solid, then we start to get in the shaft. And then,
yeah, I would just add to that. Every major manufacturer at this point has, you know, 4 to, I think, up to 7 different iron lines. I mean, the reality is, if you had to fit with one brand, I think you could go as far as making a pretty solid argument that you could find a good fit for 99% of players within a particular brand. You know, I know for me, if a guy does come in with a little bit of bias, you know, I'll allow that to influence and steer the conversation a hair. But I think one thing we should continue to point out is that within the fitting, we are using a technology called TrackMan, which is a launch monitor, which collects all of our data. You know, there's some particular data points, especially when it comes to driver. You want to start looking at ball speed, and there's going to be a certain launch angle and a certain spin rate that's going to maximize that distance. And we're, you know, irons, we're starting to look at, you know, what I was going to say is, you know, when you use the player as feedback, we do want to know their level of ability, right? So if they're already a scratch golfer or a high handicap, between those manufacturers, we know probably which head or two they're going to fit into. I personally like to mix it up a little bit. I like to compare different manufacturers, especially if there is a bias. But our hope with every part of the fitting is to allow the data to speak for itself. It's to where we can try to leave opinion out of it. Yeah, but we do have to listen to the evidence, and there's some objective data that is going to be super, super important that we have to take into consideration. And hopefully, again, leaving out any opinion in the process to where, based on these characteristics, based on your speed, based on your dispersion, based on your height, based on your stopping power, distance control, this one is a clear front runner.
Yeah, I think what I'll add to that, Joe, is that when I have people come in for fittings that I don't know anything about, and they come off the street, and I've never seen them swing a golf club, I will let them know, you know, we've got five or six different brands up here, and I can find a golf club within these brands that you're going to hit well. You know, every one of these vendors makes a really good golf club, and the product, you know, throughout the wall is phenomenal. So some of the attention to detail facts in here of aesthetics, you know, what does this look like to you when you put the golf club down? Do you have a pre-bought bias? I might get a guy that comes in that says, I've been playing Titleist clubs for 20 years. I love Titleist clubs, and I only want to hit a Titleist iron. So although he could hit golf clubs in the other five manufacturers, he's already predetermined that a Titleist iron is going to be the best fit for him. Taking that into consideration. And then also, you know, details. What does a golf club feel like? What does it sound like to you when you hit it? TrackMan, again, is going to probably give us some pretty good data if we're doing a good job at putting you in the right piece of equipment, no matter what the vendor is. Better player or not, people are going to generally gravitate towards. I gravitate towards a Titleist golf club because I like the feel.
Shameless plug.
I gravitate towards, you know, a smaller blade size head, but with a cavity back feel, so I can have a little bit of forgiveness because I don't hit it on the center every time. If the golf club or the top line of the golf club is a little thicker, then I usually draws my mind away from it. So those are my predetermined biases.
Yeah, so if I were to summarize that, you know, because I do get the question, we all do on a regular basis, all right, what's the best out there? I mean, is it Titleist? Is it TaylorMade? Is it Callaway? So on. And, you know, the line that I find myself repeating a lot is, listen, if you've heard of the company, if you've heard of the brand prior, it's good stuff. Right. And that's where the club fitting becomes so important, when it ultimately allows you to make a decision on what you should move forward with. And with the advancements of technology and with the ceilings on technology, I mean, there's only so much farther we can go at this point with improving what's already been created. At least that's what it feels like. So, I do think it's a good point to make that, you know, ultimately when it comes to finally making that decision, we can put a priority on aesthetics and feel.
I think we're professional fitters here. You know, we've been doing this for a really long time with every level of player. So it's not going to take us a really long time to find a golf club that's going to maximize your potential.
Nope. All right. So here we are with the irons. We've allowed them to hit theirs. We collected that data. We've went and said, let's grab three different heads, maybe four, depending on the player and how well they can hit it. You know, it does, I will say, if you're really consistent, you can probably handle a few more heads because you're not taking nearly as many swings to get good data. You know, we try to delete the outliers of really poor shots so we can really compare apples to apples. But let's say we hit three or four different heads. We've collected all that data. What's next?
So let's pretend we found the head that works. Like, it felt good. It's objectively better than the other ones. Then we start to get into shaft. So, you know, most people think shaft is just, you know, regular stiff, extra stiff, but there's a lot more to it than that. There's, you know, weight, there's kick points. It's all going to affect how that club performs. It's going to affect how it interacts with the turf. A club with a little bit higher kick point is going to help you lean that shaft forward. A club with a little bit lower kick point is actually going to maybe help you launch it higher, but also if you struggle getting your attack angle down, it might make it a little bit harder to hit down on the ball.
What is kick point,
so
Kyle?
Kick point is essentially where you're going to, it's obviously going to flex throughout the entire shaft, but I don't want to try to use the word kick in the definition of kick point, but if you imagine like one part of the shaft, like flexing and firing harder than the rest of it, a higher kick point would be up near the grip, which would actually launch the ball lower, and a lower kick point would be closer to the head, which would help launch the ball higher.
So when we're trying to navigate and make a decision, let's say specifically to kick point, we're looking at data points such as how high are they hitting it. We're looking at their spin rate. We might even hear at Smart Golf, since we've got the video, and we're also golf coaches, which could be a whole nother discussion about how getting fit by your golf coach has its, severe advantages. But, right now, guy that you're not coaching, we're looking at height, we're looking at spin rate, we're looking at launch angle. Are you looking at low point, and are you looking at their shaft lean at impact as you start to determine where to go with that?
I do take a look at low point attack angle, especially if we see a difference. And, we can also talk about like shaft deflection down too. I've fit people where it's like, all right, all the best shots for shaft A and shaft B are exactly the same. But shaft A, I only had to throw out one or two of those outliers where they just didn't quite hit it solid because they were hitting an extra degree down on it and because they were hitting it a little bit closer to the center of the face versus shaft B, they're not hitting down as much, so they maybe catch a little heavy from time to time and they're catching a little more towards the heel just as a whole. So yeah, I look at contact quite a bit because you might not see a huge difference in the performance on the best shots. What we want to do, especially with any club, is we want to see consistency. So if I can find a shaft that's going to help the player hit the center of the face more often, like that's a really, really good starting point. Even if it, maybe isn't the longest shaft, I'd sacrifice 4 or 5 yards to hit it the same distance every time versus catch those couple that are a little bit further.
Yeah, I think one thing with shafts, and as we venture into woods, and I've learned through the years, is it's not just about swing speed. Everybody comes in and I swing it at 105, so I'm a stiff shaft. That's not necessarily the case. There's a lot to do with load in your transition, how you're transitioning from the top of your backswing into your downswing, how hard that pull is. Like Kyle said, how much are you kicking the tip of the shaft down, into delivery and then into impact? So, I went in for a club fitting personally for me. This was 10 or 15 years ago, almost pre-TrackMan with a driver. And my ball flight tendencies were generally pretty low. And I found out I was hitting like 4 or 5 degrees down on a driver, which is not a great thing that, science has told us. And I was in a normal stiff shaft and I went into phenomenal fitter from Titus. He's like, you're an X shaft all day. And I'm like, I swing it at like 103 miles per hour. There's no way I'm an X shaft. He's like, you're loading the shaft so hard in your transition that it's kicking so hard at the bottom that the shaft is here at impact and the head is trailing massively behind, causing you to hit 5 degrees down. And that's why you can't get the golf ball up in the air. Throws me in an X, boom, attack angle goes to neutral, and now the ball goes 20, 30 feet higher in the air at a 103 swing speed. So the point being is I'm not looking just at swing speed. I'm very – that's 50% of it for me. I'm looking at shaft weight also, and then I'm also looking at, load. What's the rhythm and tempo in the golf swing, and how hard are they loading it in transition?
Beautiful. Yeah, I was going to say, when it comes – it's easier with woods, I think, but – irons, when we're looking at the data and we're looking at dispersion versus distance, does that priority change at all depending on the player? And, you added another, I think, super important variable, which not a lot of guys think of immediately, that club fitting could have an immediate impact on. Well, we do, but is contact point, right? Where are we hitting it on the face? But I'm just curious, what is the answer there? Like, if I'm getting fit for my irons here, what's some of the most important data I should consider as it pertains to distance and or accuracy?
So, I mean, if you really wanted to dive maybe too deep into it, you would kind of look at it almost from a strokes gain perspective. It's like, all right, I want to get as much distance as I can without ruining dispersion. And you got to remember that the shorter you hit it, the less offline you're going to hit it just overall, because the ball's not going as far. So if you are somebody that really struggles for distance, you know, maybe you do want to sacrifice a little bit of the left to right to pick up a little bit. Now, if you're somebody who's swinging your 7-iron at 95 miles an hour and, you know, you're really compressing it and you're, you know, carrying it 185, like, yeah, maybe we do need to find whatever is going to hit the straightest and most consistent distance versus trying to pick up a couple extra yards. I'd, you know, drop you back to 180 to tighten up a couple feet left to right versus try to keep you up at 185 with a couple extra feet left to right.
And that can rightfully change throughout the life of a student's golf swing. You know, I've had high school kids come in like Nico. When he started, he was, you know, 100 pounds, and he was trying to hit it, you know, couldn't hit it 195 yards with his driver. We put him in an iron that was giving him a ton of kick, and then his golf swing got better. He started getting bigger and stronger and faster, and we needed to change him out of that shaft. He didn't need help with producing speed and kick in his golf swing. He had plenty of distance. Now he needed the control factor.
Makes sense. All right, so we've got club head. We've got shaft flex. We've landed on that. All right, what about length and what about lie? How the heck do we figure that out?
So length, you can generally...
Like, are we doing the old-fashioned, you know, wrist to floor? Are we doing the old school put tape on the bottom of the iron and hitting off a lie board? Are there pros to that? Are there cons to that? Where are we at?
The measurements, the wrist to floor stuff, honestly, it's a good place to start, I think. Again, you can get pretty darn close. But there are other things to consider. Again, without getting too technical, like if you're somebody who can't really side bend very well, you can actually keep your arm a little more tucked by having a little bit longer club. So there are plenty of people who should theoretically be standard length, but they play them 1/2 inch, 3/4 inch over, and they can actually get into like a better impact position because of the longer club.
So let me follow up on that. Such a good point. Do you think, you know, you start to think of the biggest club fitter companies throughout the country, and we know that they only fit clubs. We obviously fit clubs, and we obviously know the golf swing biomechanics extremely well. Would you venture out to say that most club fitters are paying attention to a side bend of a player when they're getting fit and taking that into consideration when they determine the length?
No, but I also think that's like a little unfair because that's not really their job. Their job is to get you fit, and they're going to get you.
I don't care if it's fair. It's a fact that they might be limited in their ability relative to a guy that coaches for a living. And I want to highlight that, as this is a podcast to showcase smart golf and fitness instruction.
Now, the thing I will say is, like, if you're fitting somebody off the street, you're probably going to have to do it differently than somebody who you've been working with for 6 months. Like, you don't know if that person's actually going to, you know, make the improvements in their swing that you think they should make.
Well, that's such a good point. And we did skip over a part. We do interview the player prior to getting started. And obviously, that's the type of stuff we're trying to figure out initially. A question we're going to get here to shortly is, you know, asking the player, do you plan on changing your golf swing? What's the goal here? Are you here because you do not want to work on your golf game? Are you trying to fulfill like the instinct of being a human and instant gratification that you're convinced that by getting fit for clubs, that's the answer? That's going to take you to your miserable rounds, to your, you know, to rounds that you would consider a lot more fun? Because we have those conversations. And I think that, you know, being a coach here at Smart Golf, we know a player is going to change their golf swing. They know they're jumping in a program with us. Shoot, that might eliminate the fitting completely at that point, right? But it'll definitely be information that we're going to consider with how we fit them. Because, I mean, I'll be honest, I've fit guys for future golf swings and told them about that, and they've been okay with that. Because if we already know that we're going to be changing your golf swing, well, we don't want to fit you into equipment that's complementary to your crap pattern at this point.
I mean, take somebody who's like early extending like crazy and just dumping that toe into the ground. Like, you couldn't get a club upright enough for them. It's like, what are you going to do? Fit them into a 6 upright club? Like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. as a professional club fitter, it's a science, okay? And it's not an exact science. Like, there is some educated guess going on in some of this. You're not, the person at the other end of that golf club is not a robot. So they are not producing, unless you're a tour level player, they're not producing the same exact pattern over and over and over and over and over that would be required of getting an exact perfect fit. So in my eyes, every fitter, the art of fitting is, you know, the fitter that you get and his knowledge and his ability to navigate through some of these things and these data, pieces of data, and being able to envision what this golf club fits into your perfect type of golf swing. That's the nuances of the art of fitting.
No doubt. So we've got club head, we've got shaft flex. We're starting to determine length. You said, you know, you're not opposed to starting with wrist to floor. I don't think that's bad information to have. You know, we discussed that, you know, length can play a role in the style in which you swing and your current technique, which then allowed us to go down a little bit deeper conversation and wondering whether this guy is actually going to change his golf swing or not. But you have to pay attention to the direction the golf ball is traveling. That was one of the biggest changes for me as I used to be a fitter, a little bit, call it old school, if you will. I was using the lie board. I was using the tape. We've learned now that there's some limitations with that, especially the ball literally bounces in the air after you hit the lie board, especially at the wrong time. But the reality is, depending on how that club interacts with the ground, that is 100% going to have influence on the shot shape and the direction in which you're hitting it. So if you're a player that does have a tendency to have a little fan to the right, a little bit of a slice pattern, there are areas in the build of the club in which we can manipulate to minimize that. And that's why it's so important to know whether or not you're a player that plans to change your pattern at some point, because if we know you're not and you're just a guy that says, hey, just let me do the best with what I have, which that exists, there's a market for sure, well, then we're going to fit you some equipment that complements your shit, but ultimately would be equipment that would act, could hinder your ability to chase a more preferred pattern that would ultimately heighten your ceiling of potential anyway. So that's where I think we have to mention when it comes to determining the length, because we know length has an impact on dynamic lie. You know, I forget the exact ratio off the top of my head, but for every, I think, quarter inch of a length is, I think, roughly
half inch.
Yeah.
Every half inch is 1 degree either upright or flat.
Exactly. That's important.
Yeah.
So, you know, not only are we taking static measurements, but we have to pay attention to what that ball flight. If you're a hooker of the ball or slicer of the ball, that's 100% going to play a role in what length and lie angle we ultimately determine.
Yeah, I think, I mean, all of us that have put a golf club down that's, for me, that's miles too long and the toe stands, you know, way up in the air when it's on the floor and you're trying to swing and flatten this club head out and your hands go up, you know, 10 degrees more upright through the swing, that's obviously going to have a huge effect on the technique of my golf swing.
Yeah, 100%. One thing you do have to remember, though, for the listeners out there is, where the club is at address is not necessarily where it's going to be at impact. If you sit your hands pretty low, that toe is going to look like it's way up in the air, but you might deliver it perfectly flush to the ground at impact.
A super important point to highlight, because we get that question all the time. Is it okay if the toe is in the air? And it's like, yes, of course.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
One of my best ball strikers, Ross Baker, shout out. He's got his toe like a full inch in the air, and he squares it up perfectly every single time. So that's why the key word there is dynamically. We're looking at that lie angle through the hit, mm-hmm. not so much at address. And I just wanted to add, you know, we talked about how we can manipulate ball flight with lie angle and length. That's where, you know, as a better player or someone that might not have, they might actually have a pretty good golf swing, but they tend to overhook it. Well, that might not require a swing chain. You might be a player that could really, really benefit from just a change in shaft length or lie angle mm-hmm. or shaft flex and how it kicks. Mm-hmm. So that's where club fitting, again, is so important. All right, so let's keep moving the conversation along. We've got club head figured out. We've got shaft flex. Let's say we've got length. You know, we might have a grip conversation. Do you want to go in depth on a grip conversation at all? Good. Neither do I. Some of that's, mainly that's just preference. But now I think the next logical progression would be, all right, let's figure out shaft or set makeup and start to have the gapping conversation. Yes, we could skip that and go straight to driver, sure, but let's go in order, right? So what does that mean? What does set makeup and gapping mean, Todd?
So, you know, you can start at whatever end you want, from the driver and work towards the wedge, or the wedge to work down towards the driver. But like Kyle said, if I'm going through a fitting, I'm generally fitting my player for a set of irons first. And then based upon whatever that set of irons is, if they start at a 4-iron and they go through a pitching wedge or a gap wedge, I'm going to find out what the lofts are on those particular clubs. And then gapping is just matching the golf clubs at each end of your set off of those. So if we have the old, you know, adage that you might have 3 or 4 degrees difference in loft between iron, and let's say that my iron set ends at a gap wedge, which might be 48 degrees in loft, how do I fill in the rest of my set? How many other wedges do I need? Do I need a 52-degree wedge, a 56-degree wedge, and a 60, based upon how far that I'm hitting the golf ball with those particular clubs? Same thing down at the bottom of the set. I start my iron set at a 4-iron. I hit my 4-iron roughly 205 to 210 yards in the air, okay? So knowing that, my next club up, my hybrid, 19 or 20 degree hybrid that I use, goes, when I hit it well, 220 to 225 in the air. So my 4-iron, you know, carry distance 210 to 215. What's the next club? Next club's a hybrid, carry distance 220, 225. What's the next club after that? 3-wood or a 4-wood that I can carry 235 to 240, hit 250 if I need to. That's the top end of my set. And then I go down in the wedge, the bottom end, I hit my gap wedge 48 degrees, 119 yards. What's the next club? I have a 54-degree sand wedge that I can hit 100 to 105. And then the next club down is a 60-degree that I can hit 80 to 85 yards. So the gapping, I want to have consistent, really the lofts don't matter much. It doesn't really matter what the loft is. It's really, you want to get the data on, you know, what carry numbers are you trying to get to, and then making sure that you don't have these massive gaps in distance between your golf clubs where one goes 25 yards farther than the next club down.
Perfect. When it comes to wedges, Kyle, you can take this, and we're having the conversation of gapping, but we also got to take into consideration their short game technique, right? And what club they want to chip with. Where do those conversations merge? How do you navigate those?
Yeah, so let's start with, you know, where to stop your iron set and where to start your wedges. Is, do you see your gap wedge as an 11 iron, or do you see your gap wedge as another wedge that you might use around the green? If you're like, listen, I'm taking out my 60 around the green every single time, basically no matter what, get the iron set, or the one from the iron set, because you're going to be using it for full swings. Let's keep that as consistent as possible. That's my take on it anyways. You'll see a lot more like younger tour players now go to more wedges, like let's say Vokies, even down to like pitching wedges. They'll go to like 46 degree wedges because they do like to manipulate those a little bit more, use them around the green. I kind of like to start with that. And one thing to also keep in mind, like Todd said, don't necessarily get bogged down on what the lofts are. If you've got a 48 degree gap wedge that's like a little beefier and actually has a little pop to it, you might only have to go to a 50 degree, you know, wedge, Vokey, whatever, and you'll still have your like 10, 15 degrees or yards of, you know, gap between the two. You know, and then you start to get into technique. It's like, all right, what do you want to use these wedges for? If I'm mainly doing square face shots, mainly taking full swings with, you know, my gap wedge and my sand wedge, let's say, sand wedge being like a 54 or 56 degree, then I probably don't need some crazy grind. And I can probably go, if we're talking Vokey, because that's what a lot of people are, you know, familiar with. It's like,
shout out.
We're going to go with, you know, the F grind, where, you know, we don't have a lot of that metal shaved off along the back.
Wait, what's grind?
I'm trying to explain it as best I can on a non-visual podcast.
It's an F grind.
Hey, we got visual.
We got visual. But so if you take a look at the bottom of the club, you'll see, you know, a letter and a number. The number is the bounce. All right, that's essentially how high, you know, in degrees that leading edge is off the ground. If you go from the bottom, draw a line up to that leading edge, there's your bounce. Lower bounce, that leading edge is sitting closer to the ground. Higher bounce, higher or further up from the ground. And then we get into grind. Grind is basically, you know, takes into account like a little bit of the width of the sole and where you see some of that, you know, metal on that trailing edge and the heel and toe shaved off. So that's called, you know, trailing edge heel toe relief. Now, what that does is that allows you to manipulate that club and still keep that leading edge in a relatively similar spot. If you don't plan on manipulating that club, if you don't plan on opening that face, then who cares? So just play that full grind, right? Get enough bounce that you're not going to stab that leading edge into the ground. But if you do like to open it up a lot, like for a while, I basically used my 56 for almost everything. And I was like, I'm only going to use my 60 degree if I need to like lay it down. So I played a low bounce 60 degree with a ton of, you know, heel, toe, trailing edge relief. So that thing laid flat and that leading edge stayed low. So even off tight lies, I could get under it. And then I decided, how often am I hitting big daddy flops like that? Not that often. So I went to something a little bit more standard. It's got, you know, enough relief in the back. It's got a 10 degree bounce. Like it's pretty versatile all the way around.
So I think if I was an amateur golfer listening to this high handicap and I'm hearing grinds and F grind and bounce and, you know, loft, et cetera, you know, I think the knee jerk reaction is probably like, oh, man, that's way too in depth and detailed for me. I just need a club I'm trying to make contact with. What would be your response to that?
My response is one, more bounce is probably going to be your friend more often than not. It's going to let you, you know, not stab that leading edge in the ground as easily. You know, wider sole is probably going to help most players, especially if they're beginners. And if you do want to do something that's a little, you know, different with like the 60 degree, get like most of them have like their standard ish grind. Like Titleist is the S grind. Mizuno is actually the S grind as well. It's just like a little bit of trailing edge relief that we can subtly manipulate it if you wanted to feel like you're opening the face a little bit, but it's nothing crazy. And that's kind of where I'd stick around. 10, 12 degrees of bounce. Keep that grind pretty basic.
In other words, I still hear you might be an amateur, you might not be very good, but there's still advantages to getting fit, trying out different wedges, because not all 18s are treated equal, you know, especially when it comes to the short game, right? You know, there's a lot of different ways to get the ball onto the green from around it, and not everyone has that exact. So there might be a really high handicapper that could benefit from less bounce, so right?
There could be. I will say this is one area where, like, I would say you can really get yourself in trouble if you just go grab a wedge off the rack and you get that 4 degree bounce tee grind, Yeah, you love it because you're a good player who likes to, you know, manipulate the face and you play off tight lies at these nice courses around here. But like if you're just playing your local muni where it's underwater half the season and you're just stabbing that leading edge into the ground, but you bought this brand new, you know, wedge at, you know, wherever, like you're gonna have a bad time. Like,
agree completely.
So it's one of those things where just have somebody like just make sure you got what you need.
I was just gonna add, I mean, you could give me a wedge different than what I'm currently using, and I will use the exact same technique that I currently use, same loft, but different bounce of grind. It will make me look very silly. Very silly.
Yeah, I would figure it out,
but now I have to change my technique and I don't want to do that.
Correct.
I'm a firm believer that if you get a really good player in front of you, that they're going to navigate into whatever wedge eventually over enough time. They're going to change their technique to figure out what that wedge is.
They will, but that's the reason. I mean, I've heard stories of maybe it was Tiger, maybe it was another high level tour player, but they, when it comes to even a driver, if they pick up a club and all of a sudden it feels a little off or it's a little bit of a weird ball flight, they're going to stop swinging it immediately after two or three swings because they know that sure. they will adjust.
They will figure it out.
And yeah. They do not want
to. What I would add to that is the majority of the people that I'm fitting with wedges, you know, I'm trying to find one wedge, like a 60, that built for, this is going to be your bunker club. Okay. We're going to put maybe a little bit more bounce on this golf club when you're around the greens and you need to hit it out of the sand, or you need to hit it a little bit higher and you need some forgiveness on there. This is going to be built for that. We might give you a 52 or a 54 or 56 that you're going to hit some other shots around the green that's not your bunker club. Versatility to hit it a little bit lower, might get a little bit of chip and run out of it. So When I'm fitting my players on that, I like to give them the versatility of having almost two different options within their set of wedges.
To kind of jump from wedges and then back, kind of like tie it into you know, gapping in set makeup, that's another thing to kind of consider. Is everybody's like, all right, let's do the 4-degree gaps, you know, 50, 54, 58, 52, 56, 60. But if you're somebody who's really good at dialing in wedges, you might be better off going straight from 52 to 60. It's a huge gap, but that would actually give you the freedom to toss another hybrid in or something like that, or 5-wood or 7-wood, where you actually need that help a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Maybe, but maybe not. Maybe if you're really bad at taking those partial wedge shots, like, keep those gaps really tight.
I think that's a great point, because I was going to ask, when does a player determine that they should need more in their long game versus their wedges? Because we've got some players that have 5 wedges, right? We've got some players that only have 2. And again, it goes back to the common recurring theme here. That's why it's so important to get fit. Know your game, because it's very individualized, right? And that definitely depends on your playing ability and your swing speed's a big part of it. Okay, so do we feel good about, you know, discussing kind of how the fitting process starts, as far as, you know, you're going to come in for your irons, you're going to go club head, shaft flex. We'll start to figure out length and lie angle. Got our ways of doing that. Now we're looking at gapping. We went through wedges. I think we did a really good job to exhaust that part of the conversation, you know, and then I think we pretty, you know, not as isolated, but we talked about kind of how the woods gapping is the same. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you guys want to shed any light on driver fitting per se, but it's, for me, it's really, really straightforward. You know, everyone comes in with a relatively, you know, they have their swing speed. With that swing speed, assuming, you know, contact, they have a certain ball speed. And we all know now that based on someone's ball speed, which is a really important variable, you're going to find out an ideal launch angle and spin rate to help maximize carry and distance. Now, that's not always the same, depending on where you play and what the conditions are. You alluded to it earlier. If you're a guy that, you know, plays in wet conditions, you might prioritize carry over total, you know, whereas a guy might be playing in the desert and it's a little bit more dry, and rolls comes, you know, as a, what's the word, you know, massive benefit. You might prioritize just overall distance, where you can hit these little low bullets, because maximizing total distance is not the same as maximizing total carry. Yeah. But you guys can go ahead and expound upon that. But driver fitting, I think, is one of the, it's very, you know, we've talked about irons. It's a very similar process, but it's, you know, very easy.
Yeah, I think for me, and with technology and the advancements that we've made with not only the driver, but with the ball, and, you know, we were going to talk about that briefly, but you can launch the driver so high now with such little spin. That I remember back in the day that you used to hit a driver and the ball, you know, it looked like an airplane taking off. It would start low and then the spin would rise the ball in the air. And you just don't see that anymore based upon technology and the ball and the driver. So I would imagine most people that watch our show are probably, you know, asking the same questions that we ask. I want to hit it as far as I possibly can and as straight as I possibly can, right? Well, you know, some sacrifices you have to make. These manufacturers, if they're moving center of gravities around in the club head, you're going to have to give or sacrifice in one area. So if you gain a little bit in the speed department, you might be, sacrificing a fraction in the direction department. There's manipulations we can make and change around in the driver to help do that. But, you know, for my players, it's always like, well, let's find the driver that you can hit the hardest and let's get maximize the distance first. And then I'm going to tune you in directionally from there. And that's kind of how I approach my driver fittings.
I generally go along those lines as well. Nobody's going to hit every fairway. So don't expect to hit, you know, 20 balls dead center. Like for every 20 yards of distance. So if you pick up 20 extra yards of distance, that negates a missed fairway. Does that make sense?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Cool. So as long as you're not, you know, mapping balls into people's backyards, it's okay to miss fairways, especially if you're gaining some distance. Now, if we're gaining 20 yards, but all of a sudden now we lose 2 extra balls out of bounds, that's a different story. But in general, that's probably not going to happen. So yes, I'm with Todd. Distance, and then we'll tighten it up from there.
Love it. And nothing to add. I guess the one thing I would just say is, it's again, if you're a player, especially a high swing speed, well, either higher or slow speed.
Yeah, that actually,
I was just going to say is, and you're not fit well, you know, complementary to your movement pattern, not your movement pattern, but your how fast you move the club, you could obviously, I'm sorry, I'm just struggling getting this out, but there's a massive disadvantage to not being fit with your any correct, part of your game, correct, including yeah. your drivers, all
yeah.
I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and with speed comes the ability to be less efficient and not have it kill you as much. You know, if you're a slower speed player, we want to launch the ball super high with no spin so it goes, you know, as far as it can. But if you're a higher swing speed player and you're sacrificing 15 yards, but you're still hitting at 315, but now you are hitting more fairways, like that's where that switch does kind of flip a little bit, you know, to an extent, right? Distance does kill, but if, you know, you can dial it back a little bit and pick up a couple fairways and you're already hitting it far enough that you're hitting wedges into most greens, then that's something to look at. So like, you know, 2000 RPMs of backspin is probably going to be about the range where it's going to get you the most distance, but you're going to see most tour guys at like 2,500. That way they can have a little bit more, you know, flexibility if they pull one or push one to still maintain some consistency there.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would just highlight, you start to look at, we know that a five attack angle relative to a zero or a negative five is going to maximize your distance. That's just fact. But then you look at the tour average, which is negative 1.3, which, by the way, that is not hitting down on the ball. Center of the gravity is located in the back of the driver. As the driver travels up, the back of the club goes up, so you still get a negative 1.3. Reading last I learned, negative 1.3 is still technically hitting up on it. But that being said, they're not at five. We can all agree on that. And the reason that you just said is they find that they have a little bit more control because they swing it fast enough and are willing to sacrifice their max distance.
We had a Korn Ferry Tour player that was, you know, training in here when, you know, COVID was going on, and he was trying to hang out around 3,000 RPMs. And most people that come in here would lose their minds if they were hitting 3,000 RPMs soon. But he also swung at 125, so he was still hitting at 320.
So how can the average player and listener, you know, how can they figure out some of this data? What has been the biggest game changer in terms of club fitting over the last 30 years?
Yeah, launch monitors.
Yeah.
TrackMan.
Without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, when we started, we were fitting, I was telling Kyle a story earlier, rolling out these, you know, massive fitting carts on the range and tape on the bottom, and we had no launch monitors, and you were going off of feel and ball flight.
Just vibes.
And, yeah. And you'd pull out 25 different clubs and hit them, and now TrackMan has been, I mean, TrackMan is the best fitter on the planet.
Exactly. I was going to ask is, before we get into putting and ball, when do you prioritize lessons over fitting? We have a guy who walked in the door, and he wants to get fit for clubs. But what might transpire to where we go lessons over club fitting? Let's talk about that.
I mean, I've had guys come in for fittings that literally can't get the ball airborne. Like, dude, what are you? You're not fitting anything. Like, we're not going to find anything. I did have a guy come in and say, I want to get fit for swing weight, and he hosled every single ball. It's like, we're not going to find anything today.
Okay, so number one, they have an inability to give you any sort of relevant data to compare and actually allow someone to feel good about taking your credit card to sell equipment that has no positive impact on your game. Okay, that would be one. What else?
That was going to be my answer. I had a guy come in about a month ago to do a fitting, and every shot was straight off the hosel. Hosel rocket, hosel rocket, hosel rocket. So we started talking about technique, and I said, you need to fix your golf swing before you can actually get an accurate fit.
Fair. The only thing I would add, and we did touch on it earlier, is it comes down to their interview. And if within that question, hey, why are you getting fit for clubs? If the answer is because I'm trying to be as good at golf as I possibly can be, right? And then we go into the hitting bay, or they're saying, hey, I'm just, you know, I want to hit it X amount farther or straighter or hit more green, you know, whatever the answer is. But they get into the hitting bay, and obviously they might not be hosling it, but their swing is just awful. Like, no matter what new driver you put in their hand, no matter what set of irons you put in their hand, you're not moving the needle very much. But you know that their goal is to move the needle. Well, then we got to have a hard conversation. Mm-hmm. Because if you're about to drop 2-3K on a brand new set of equipment because you want to play better, there's a better place to make that investment. And that's into your golf swing. Because if you invest 2-3K into your golf swing right now, I can take the equipment that you're currently using and have you play way better than you purchasing brand new equipment. And that's a reality. And that's, call it, you know, pro con, whatever you will, but coming in the smart golf and getting fit, you know, we're going to be honest with you. We're not just trying to make a sale. We want to see you play better golf, period. And in a lot of cases, yeah, it requires some instruction, and I get it. That's not the short short route. That's the hard route. But if you're genuinely serious about getting better, you need to be willing to have that conversation and take it seriously. All right, let's go to putter. Let's talk about putter fitting as a whole. Like, come on, man. You walk into a PGA Superstore, they've got 300 different putters. And isn't it, you just go grab one, pick one up, see what one looks well, and see what one, you know, fill in the bottom of the cup and walk out?
Mm-hmm. It's just pure vibes, man.
No. Yeah.
So putting is kind of a weird one where there is plenty of science to back up that a putter makes a huge difference. Everything from the sight line to the shape to the hosel will affect how you line that putter up, how you swing that putter, and how you, you know, square that face. That being said, there are people that putt well with bullseyes. I think I like to generally have people take a look at a couple putters, see if anything like kind of catches their eye, but then we're going to go straight to Sand Putt Lab and we're going to take a look at their tendencies. And if they're like, hey, I'm dead set on this spider, then I will try to find the spider configuration that works best for them. And that might mean like, all right, they thought they were going to get, you know, that face balanced, you know, double bend, and we end up with just a little slant neck that's got a lot of toe hang to it. But they still get kind of the sight line that they want and everything like that. Or we might find that like that putter does not really fit their stroke at all. And they walk out the door with something completely different. I don't know, you guys, I'm sure can elaborate, but there is a lot of kind of funny stuff that can go on with putters.
Putting can be a wild card. However, it is something you should take very seriously when it comes to getting fit and determining what you're going to put in your bag. We all know the common, hey, you're going to take out your putter on every hole and use it, you know, more than any other club in the bag. You know, we did a whole shoot. We spent 6 months of our coaches meetings just really diving really deep into researching putting fitting. And we just, the more we learned, the more we realized we didn't know. And the more, I mean, we could spend 3 episodes talking about putting fitting, no problem. So, you know, because we use Sand Putt Lab, but there's another technology out there called Quintech. You know, now Bettinardi, they just opened up their studio, shout out. And that really isolates the ball, right? So they're starting to say there's certain characteristics in delivery which are going to produce a certain amount of skid, then a certain amount of roll. And depending on what that is, there's an ideal to help you maintain your line. Mm-hmm. You know, so you take that into consideration. And then, all right, once you start to know and you learn about skid and roll, well, then you start to get some insight on what their loft should be. Right, with what's nice with Sam, and Quintech might have this now, but it's measuring everything about the club head, right? So we know what their loft is. We know what their attack angle. So there's obviously some technique that we will, more so than irons, maybe offer a little bit of advice and technique during a putter fitting, especially when it comes to determining length, you know, and loft and lie, because posture can play a huge role within that. But yeah, I will just say this. Technically, you know, when it comes to toe hang or a face balance putter, there is a lot of studies out there that say certain strokes are complementary to one of those styles, right? And certain head styles, whether it's mallet or blade, certain hosels are complementary to certain styles of stroke. What we've determined with all of this, number one, I think you should get fit, because the number one variable we find to be higher than any other when it comes to importance is are you confident with this bad boy in your hand? Right, because we could listen to all the science in the world. If we have a really good player, or really any player, I guess, for that matter, it's less common with poorer players or higher handicappers, I should say. We could have all the science supporting that this is the putter based on all of the data that we've collected, but they're like, no, I look down at this one and I just absolutely love it. We are not arguing with that guy. So I think at the very least, without going super deep into this putting conversation, just be really, really happy and confident with whatever putter you decide to go with.
Yeah, we can adjust the lie angle and we can adjust the length and we can adjust the loft around the sexiness of the putter that you look down at and like. And we can get the ball through Sand Putt Lab and through the genius of what we are as golf professionals to roll off the face and over in and down your target line without a lot of, you know, a ton of hop and bounce. And if we can do that and produce the perfect roll off of the face, we can kind of build your favorite putter into what works absolute best for your technique.
100%. I was just going to say that's one area where there's a lot of preference we allow, especially when it comes to grip thickness as well.
Yeah, so putting, I think, is one of those funny ones where I think you can get really good results with something that statistically doesn't make sense for you. However, I think if you do go in, I think putting is one of those things where if you do go in really objectively and actually go through the whole process and follow it to a T, I do think that you can see some serious benefit as long as you're like, listen, I feel really confident that this is the right thing for me. Because I've got a guy that literally putts with a tour edge putter that he's like, I don't know how I ended up with this thing. He's a plus two handicap. Like I'm putting with this ridiculous thing. But I roll it great. And, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, I would say one last thing I would say on putting. One area we do tend to put a pretty significant importance on is how you aim it. So we do have some ways that we can determine how well you aim. And believe it or not, not all putters are equal. You know, so we can have a guy look down with a certain putter that maybe is a blade that doesn't have a line on top, and he tends to just aim every single thing to the left. Where we put a mallet down in front of him with lines all over the place and he lines up perfect, vice versa. But, you know, what we like to try to keep constant and then build backwards from there is the fact that you have something in your hand that you're really good at aiming with.
There was a time when Dustin Johnson went through putter fitting. They were all the exact same spider putter, and he tried with no line, with a dot, with a short line, with a long line, with a double line, and until he found the one that worked for him. He's like, he aimed them all different. Other than that, they were the exact same putter. So every little thing makes a difference. You could have the same like general size putter, but a round back is going to aim differently than a square back. You know, a long line is going to aim differently than a short line. Yeah. The visuals make a huge difference.
All right, let's do a quick little rapid fire on a few different pieces of subject matter before we conclude, and we'll just talk about them briefly. But let's start with shaft peering. That I know that's a big thing, and one of the companies we spoke to earlier. I see a lot of guys that come from there that said they got their shafts peer and their 18 handicaps and they got charged a boatload for it. I do question it, but I'm just curious. First of all, what is shaft peering, and what are your guys' thoughts on it?
So shaft peering is aligning that spine of the shaft essentially with basically right at the bottom of the club so that when it kicks, it's kicking the same way every single time. You're not basically going against that spine. I do think at a certain point, shaft peering made a ton of sense. However, I think manufacturing tolerances have gotten so much better now that it, for the average golfer, probably does not matter as much. However, listen, if you want, you know, best of the best, top of the line, like, why not, right? Like, leave no stone unturned, I suppose.
You know, I agree with that. You know, if I'm a tour player and you start to look at, you know, Bryson DeChambeau at this point in time, he's trying to look under every nook and cranny and whatever. I mean, he's putting his balls in Epsom salt water, right? So I think if there's an option for you to eliminate another variable and you know that you've got your shaft orientation completely optimized and the stability is perfect and therefore, you know, there's some science that backs that it might go a little straighter, sure. Do I think that for the average handicap to spend, I don't know, whatever it is, $100 per club, I don't know if the return on investment is there.
That being said, if you get your driver shaft peered and then you change your hosel settings, you just wasted it.
True. And that's where the driver equipment is. Okay. Let me go back to my notes here. All right, let's talk about, just real quickly, are you guys familiar with hard stepping and soft stepping?
Yeah, I mean, hard stepping and soft stepping is basically to get somewhere in between flexes. So hard stepping would be taking a shorter shaft. So like taking a 9-iron shaft, putting in an 8-iron so that it plays a little bit stiffer. And soft stepping would obviously be doing the opposite. So it's a good way to get in between flexes. Or if you're like, listen, I really want a stiffer shaft, but I want in this 120-gram weight versus the 130-gram weight. You can hard step for that.
How often do you guys find yourself having that conversation?
Almost never.
Very rarely.
Let's talk about the Mizuno Shaft Optimizer. Can you explain what that is and give me your thoughts on it?
So the Mizuno Shaft Optimizer is graphite shaft. It's got a bunch of cables running through it, and it's got a basically like a little computer on it, essentially. And what it's doing is it's measuring basically swing speed. It's measuring, you know, the deflection, so how much toe up or down you are. It's measuring basically the release point and the kick so that it's basically putting you on this little 3D grid, essentially, if you can imagine that, and comparing to other players with similar tendencies and the shafts that they fit into. So you're basically seeing yourself in this 3D scatter plot of those three things I mentioned. And it's like, these are the top three shafts that'll fit you. And then if we had to keep going down the list, this is kind of the order I would go in. And, you know, assuming you're swinging that day how you normally do, it is a really, really good starting point. And chances are we'd probably get there anyways or close to it. But it's a good tool, and it kind of takes a lot of the guesswork out.
Let's discuss fitting indoors versus getting fit outdoors. I mean, there's a lot of fittings being done indoors right now. What do we say? What do you say to the player that's like, no, I got to get fit outside. I just have to. It's the only way I can get fit. Talk to me about the difference between the two. What are your thoughts, pros, cons, concerns?
I would say, you know, at face value, if you look at it, if you're getting fit indoors at a facility like ours, we're using TrackMan technology based upon, you know, 72 degrees air conditions. You've got no wind. You've got a lie that's going to be consistent and perfect every time. It's going to produce, you're going to be hitting golf shots from in the same characteristics time after time after time. So you would be comparing apples to apples in that situation. I would think when you do get into fittings outside, they can't adjust TrackMans based upon like temperatures and wind ranges and things like that. But you have the variability of the lie. The lie might change from grass to grass. You know, you might be hitting out of a fairway. You might be hitting a little lower out of a fairway. You might be hitting off of a tee. You might move the ball into the rough. What's the, you know, humidity in the air? How much effect is that having on the golf ball? What's the wind? Is it downrange?
You know, the temperature as well on your body.
Correct. Right. Temperature outside. What altitude are you at? You know, all of these things have a massive effect in you know, affecting how the golf ball flies and the distances and trajectories and spins. Whereas when you're hitting inside, you're hitting from a controlled environment every single time.
So would you say you would prefer fitting indoors versus outdoors? And would that answer be the same if you were fitting a tour player?
I would personally prefer to be fitted in hitting from the same exact consistent spot every single time so that I can compare apples to apples.
What about you?
So I kind of agree with Todd to an extent. I like the consistency of being indoors. I like that we don't have those other variables. That being said, like golf has a lot of variables. Somebody might deliver that club a little bit differently outside. So it's really hard to say.
How about just the turf interaction versus grass interaction and how that impacts data? Do you see something significant enough to where that should even be part of the conversation?
So this is where a good fitter is going to be totally fine. A good fitter will know if, you know, that ball that you hit was not great contact, but you got good numbers because it kind of bounced off the club, kind of bounced off the turf. So, you know, I think if somebody knows what they're doing, you're 100% fine getting fit indoors, but you also have to be honest with yourself and be like, oh yeah, I drop kicked that one. And if that was outside, I probably would have lost like 30 yards. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. No, I totally, I've fallen in line with that completely. I think just the other thing I'd point out is if you've got a wind that's dead in your face or wind right to left to right, let's face it, you know, those types of conditions can have some impact on how you're moving the club. So that, I think that goes in line with the point you guys are trying to make, which is just trying to keep it consistent. So we're comparing apples to apples. Let's talk launch monitors real quick. Obviously, we use TrackMan. Another big one out there is Foresight as a competitor. I know there's other ones, but those are probably the two big names. And there's a lot of guys out there that are, you know, huge fans of one or the other, and they try to make cases on why one might be better than the other. I'm just curious if you want to, what you'd share with our listeners in regard to the differences between TrackMan and Foresight when it pertains to fitting.
So I think they're both super accurate, which they are. TrackMan, when you get outside especially, is going to track that ball from the second it leaves the club until it hits the ground.
Yeah, I would just add to that, you know, guys, we're seeing guys out there outdoors now with TrackMan and Foresight now, and everyone's like, well, why do they have both? Well, the unique thing about TrackMan, and it is Doppler radar, and it tracks your ball all the way until it lands in any condition, right?
Yes.
So what tour players like to see, especially, you know, depending on the temperature, humidity, wind, etc., one, TrackMan will tell them literally how far they're hitting it, where Foresight will take a very good accurate measure of the spin rate and tell them what that stock yardage would look like in normal conditions.
So for a while, Foresight theoretically read spin rates better indoors. But now that Titleist has their RCT balls, TrackMan is dead on as well. Personally, I like TrackMan a lot for teaching because it does have a lot more club data, which is nice. And one thing to kind of make note of is they both capture club data and stuff at a slightly different time. TrackMan is max compression and Foresight is like first moment of impact. So what you'll see a lot is ball speeds being dead on, but you'll see Foresight club speeds read faster and TrackMan read a little bit slower, but with higher smash factor to make up, you know, that ball speed. So if you're doing a club fitting, you're like, wow, I swing this one way faster. You know, and you get fitted Foresight or on a Foresight in one place and you try a different club at TrackMan in another place, just know that we should probably be looking at ball speed, not club speed.
I would also just say, I don't love having to put stickers all over the club head when it comes to Foresight.
I would agree with that as well. But ball data is really, really solid.
I agree. It's good technology.
RCT balls.
RCT balls.
That's where the RCT came through.
Yeah, very nice.
I think there's some Foresight guys out there that would debate, have a strong debate and opinion on their the RCT ball, but it's been great for us and
the RCT, really aided in the fitting. The people who don't know what RCT is, it's radar capture technology. And it just helps TrackMan read spin better when it's indoors because we're only hitting it 12 feet, 15 feet. So to get a really accurate reading, having that technology in there is really nice.
Perfect. Let's discuss one final subject matter. Let's just talk about ball fitting. We've had a couple here. Can you share the audience like the importance of that and what one might look like?
Yeah. So the ball fittings that I've gone through have always been with Titleist, and generally what you're looking at, Titleist works from the green backwards. So instead of starting on the tee, we usually start around the green and we work with chips and pitch shots and we see how the ball reacts. For every individual player, we like to look at trajectory, height, obviously, and then spin rate. What's the reaction of the golf ball when it hits the green? Everybody's going to be a little bit different depending on the player. You know, a tour level player might want to see or predict a certain type of reaction from the golf ball when the ball is chipped or pitched and then it lands on the green. Some players might want to see a little bit more rollout. Moving back from the green into the fairways and then on the tees, it's going to be about spin rates. It's going to be about launch angles. It's going to be about trajectory in the air. And then it's also probably the most important thing is going to be about land angle. And land angle is, you know, at what angle the ball is approaching into the ground. You know, as you go into a driver, you know, like it goes back to what we talked about earlier, is you might want to, some players might want to launch the ball on a little lower trajectory off the tee at a lower spin in the desert so they can get more carry, or excuse me, more roll out of the golf ball once it lands. Whereas somebody that's going to be playing in wet conditions is going to be launching the ball higher with possibly more spin. The ball goes further down range in the air, but it generally has a little bit more steep of a land angle. So in a ball fitting, those are really all of the things that we're looking at. We're looking at trajectory. Again, TrackMan is beautiful for a ball fitting because it's going to tell us spin rates. It's going to tell us launch angles. It's going to tell us land angles. And then when you go out and you're actually around a real life green and you can get chip and putt, putting's simply based upon feel, you know, generally with the ball coming off the face. But I know personally that when I went through a ball fitting between the Pro V1 and the X, I noticed a massive difference in spin reaction around the greens. So that was the biggest thing for me. I didn't see a huge difference in my ball flight.
Beautiful. Anything you'd like to add to that?
Not a ton. I mean, I kind of go through it the same way Todd does, start around the green, then kind of work your way back to the tee. You know, me personally, I was Pro V1 X for a while, then I switched to the Pro V1, and then I started, you know, working on my swing and launching the ball lower. So I had to switch back to the X to get some of that stopping power that Todd was talking about, where I want that ball to come in a little bit steeper with a little bit more spin. So it's just a matter of finding out what's important to you. You know, do you want something that's going to maximize distance? Maybe you need something with a little less spin. Do you want something that's going to stop immediately? Maybe you need a little bit more spin. Maybe you're a high spin player and you need to make sure it doesn't suck back off the green. But one thing I will say is that no matter what ball you play, even if it's not the perfect ball for you, you should be consistent with it. If you're, you know, playing with a hodgepodge of four or five different golf balls, whatever you find in your bag, you know, you're going to hit one pitch that you know, stops really quick, yeah. another one that rolls out, you're better off playing not the perfect ball for you, but playing the same ball over and over so you know how it's going to react. And that's kind of what Todd was getting to. Like, you need to know how it's reacting on the green.
You think, depending on the time of the year and the temperature and the conditions, that a tour level player would ever switch from a one or X throughout the season?
So I got a fun story. That's a Marty Jurtson story. For those of you who don't know, Marty Jurtson's like one of the lead engineers at Ping, PGA professional, really good player. And he found out that PGA section events don't have a one ball rule. So what he did is he brought, I think, four different golf balls out there. And he's like, I've got a downwind short par four where I know I'm going to be hitting a wedge in. I want something that is going to like suck back, because I need to hit it past this pin because it's tucked right behind a bunker. You know, I've got a long par five that I need to like, you know, fire one off down there. I'm going to play a lower spin ball that goes a little bit further. Or I know that I'm going to have a partial wedge shot. So by playing this ball that's a little bit softer, I know I lose about 4 yards. So instead of, you know, my 85 is stock, I know I'm going to have an 80-ish yard shot. So now I take this other ball and now it's basically a stock shot. So yes, people will do that. I don't know that people are going to go crazy like that, but you definitely could. And if you really know what you're doing, which again would take some, you know, serious knowledge, which he obviously has, you could do it and be successful. It'd be bonkers, though. I wouldn't want to try it personally.
That's nuts. I lied. I got one more question to ask. You know, and if I was a listener, I would just be curious about this. You know, there's always advancements in technology every single, well, it seems like every 6 months. For a while, there were manufacturers coming out with new drivers every six months or even, you know, or 12 months, whatever it is. But it's like, have we gotten to the point yet where it's just, we've maximized everything? Is it really going to get that much better? I mean, are there any new heads this year or new technologies this year that are that much farther advanced than what existed their previous line? Todd, speak to that a little bit.
I think that the rules of golf have pretty much told us as far as we can go currently. Now, my guess would be that the production of the metals or the graphite or the titanium or the tungsten or whatever it is that we're putting in these golf clubs is only going to continue to get better. And when that gets better and we can still, you know, put the quality of this metal, but lose the, you know, bring the overall weight down or improve the center of gravity or the overall mass of the golf club, and the reaction of the ball off the face without, you know, without going over the limits of the COR, you know, that's how these, we're capped out on, like, you know, especially when they roll the ball back, the ball can only come off of the face so fast. So then, you know, based upon your swing speed and the ball can only come off at X miles per hour, you know, where are the improvements going to come? I think the improvements are going to start to come from the bottom up. So that it's going to bring the consistency level up for the higher handicap player, whereas the better player, they're going to be pretty much maxed out on what they can do with some of this stuff.
Is there anything this year from an equipment standpoint that you're excited about?
Yeah, the GT driver and fairways from Titleist are crazy legit. I know that you and I have both played with them a couple times now, and I'm hitting numbers. I'm up to 112 and a half club speed and 168 ball speed. I've never been there in my life. I'm about to turn 50. I would attribute some of that to the work and the training I've been doing, but I've also would attribute it to the golf club and the club head. And I know you said the same thing. Like, this thing is a rocket and it goes dead straight.
I'm excited. I'm pumped up for the technology from a dispersion standpoint. You know, distance is, you know, in my particular case, is relatively similar. However, the misses are much further and much straighter. I just played Butler and I hit almost every fairway. And I don't really ever do that.
Yeah, for you to do that, the technology has to be amazing.
So, yeah, that's...
How about you, Kyle?
That's kind of what Todd was saying. The biggest advancements are not going to be distance. Like, honestly, the center of the face has been maxed out since literally, like, the persimmon days. But the forgiveness is off the charts now, especially this past year. A lot of stuff has gotten a lot more forgiving. And I think that's actually part of the reason you're seeing faster ball speeds. If you were to play Persimmon and swing it at, you know, 120, you could hit it really far. But like, if you miss that by a little bit, that thing's in somebody's backyard. Whereas you can wail away on these new drivers and not really have to worry about losing it off the map. So like my whole theory with, you know, club fitting is test often, and when the dollars to benefit make sense, do it. It doesn't have to be every year, but like, give it a shot.
Guys, I think we could talk hours and hours about club fitting. I think we covered a ton of subject matter. I generally wanted to keep going because I really like talking about this stuff. But let's wrap up. I really, really appreciate you guys participating tonight and sharing your wealth of knowledge on the subject. And, you know, I would predict we'd probably do another club fitting episode in here in the future.
Yeah.
Guys, thanks so much for joining.
Cool. Thanks, you. Joe. Thanks, Kyle.
All right.
Great job.
Until next time. Cheers.
Cheers.
A big thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Everything But the Tip podcast. Stay connected with us on all social media platforms by following @SmartGolfFitness. For additional episodes, updates, and exclusive content, check out our website at smartgolffitness.com. Don't forget to show some love, like, share, and subscribe to ensure you never miss out on the latest insights and engaging discussions. Your support means the world to us. Until next time, keep swinging and stay fit.